December 2001. We are interviewing Frank Woodruff Buckles at Gap View Farm, West Virginia. His birthday is February 1st, 1901. The interviewer today is Liz McMillan. Could you tell me what branch of service you were in?
Ambulance.
In the ambulance service in World War I. Tell me whether you were drafted or did you enlist?
I enlisted in the United States Regular Army. It's quite a distinction. I did have some difficulty getting in because they were suspicious of my age. I went up to Wichita, Kansas to the state fair in the summer of 1917 while school was out. I went to the Marine recruiting station, and the sergeant told me that I was not old enough. I gave my age as 18. You had to be 21. So I went out to Larned, visited my uncle and aunt, who had formed a bank there many years before. And my grandmother was there. Came back a week later, went to the same recruiting station. Same sergeant was there, but I had increased my age to 21. He was very gentleman and gave me the test. I could pass it, but he says, you're just not heavy enough. Well, I tried the Navy. They didn't want me. Said I was flat-footed, even though I went to sea for 20 years after that. Then I went to Oklahoma City, tried them again, and went to the Army recruiting station. They sent me to Fort Logan, Colorado, where I was sworn in to the United States Regular Army. The knowledgeable old sergeant said, if you want to get to France right away, go into the ambulance corps. And they sent me to Fort Riley, Kansas, where they were training for ambulance service and trench retrieval. Oh, did I lose that?
That's okay. Why did you want to join?
I was interested in the war. I had been reading the newspaper since I was a child, and I was wireless amateur, and the war was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall what those first days in the service were like?
Well, the what?
Do you recall what the first days in the service
well,
were like?
Well, I certainly do. Yes. In the regular army in Fort Logan, it was very military. You waited to be assigned to sit down at the table until the sergeant arrived. That was the beginning there. In Fort Riley, it was quite different. We were first in tents, and the food was prepared quite different too, using the big GI cans with a fire underneath it to prepare the coffee or the soup or beans or whatever it was. Yes. Now, I haven't talked about these things in the past, only to Susanna and my wife. Nobody here knew that I was ever in World War I until quite recently, until Jacques Chirac, the the president of France decided to include the Americans.
When did you get overseas?
When did I go?
When did you get to France?
Now, the unit I belonged to, 102 men, were called the First Fort Riley Casual Detachment. And casual means unassigned. And we were expecting to go direct to France. But I went overseas on the Carpathia in December 1917. Many of the officers, some of the officers, and some of the men had been aboard when they made the rescue of the Titanic, of the survivors. our group, destined, as we thought, destined for France, were diverted in Winchester, England, to relieve a unit of the 6th Marines who had the camp hospital number 35. That changed the situation around for me. And Winchester, although I enjoyed it very much, and particularly the historical background of the area and the country, I was anxious to get to France. And I used several methods, including, I should say, pestering every officer of influence in the place, including the commandant colonel. I got an audience with the colonel, who told me that he wanted to go to France too. But it was helpful in one way, that everybody knew that I was determined to get to France. I even made up a system with three other men that at night these units would go down to Southampton to board a ship. And I knew that the route they would follow, so I had arranged with them that we would, the four of us, would be out at the end of this lane when the troops came along, and we'd just fall in with them. And going aboard the train and going aboard the ship presented no problem. But for some reason, I had to drive a little car with some officers down to Plymouth, and I didn't get back until after the period we'd arranged for. They went on to France, but they came back in about under escort and were punished for it.
What was your job assignment in Winchester?
In Winchester, I drove, first it was a motorcycle, then a sidecar. And with the sidecar, I would take on official assignments with some of the officers. Most places, the military walked. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an honor to be riding in a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. Then I was promoted to a car. Ford car. And also, as this was a camp hospital unit, I drove a motorcycle, which is also a Ford. But I eventually got on to France.
Do you remember when that was?
Pardon?
Do you remember when that was?
No, and of course, I probably had orders, but the early orders I couldn't have had it this long. I have orders for later experiences, mm-hmm. but not the first ones.
Mm-hmm. What did you do when you were in France? What was your job there?
Well, mostly driving a car. Mm-hmm. And ambulance. Mm-hmm. And I was in various places. But particularly down in the Gironde district, the small places, St. Andrew de Coupsac and Saint-Sulpice, the town of Cognac, and of course Bordeaux, and the port area of Bassens. See, when I got to France, then I was and took various assignments. My situation was different from most men belonged to one group, a unit, and for instance, after the war I belonged to the 7th Regiment of New York, and many of the men were overseas. Well, their experience you could pick up in the history of the 7th Regiment, and even down to C Company, to which I belong. Mm-hmm. But with me, I was in Europe by myself, right? Yeah. But being very young, alert, I got along well.
Mm-hmm. Were there any casualties in your unit?
Any what?
Casualties?
No.
In your unit?
Mm-hmm. No.
How far were you from combat?
Well, it depends on which place I was at. Mm-hmm. Up in, around Ishatil, I suppose I was 30, 40 miles. Mm-hmm. 30, 40 miles, a long distance in France.
Yes. Do you have any vivid memories of those months in France?
Of France?
Yes.
What I have a vivid memory of the French soldiers is being in a small village and going into a local wine shop in the evening. And here were the French soldiers, and they get very, very little money. But they were having wine and singing the Marseillaise with enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And I inquired, what is the occasion? They were going back to the front. Mm. Can you imagine it?
Mm. What was the hospital like? You said you drove an ambulance. Did you see the hospital?
Well, it was more of a dispensary. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I did take them to the hospital in Bordeaux. But I wouldn't be inside of it. Mm-hmm. Weren't very impressive to me.
Hmm. How did you stay in touch with your family?
Well, by letter, yes. No telephone in those days.
Yeah. And what was the living conditions like? What was the food like?
Well, in the army, I never complained about the food because that indicated that you came from a family where you were not fed very well, if you complained. Mm. But when I got to France, and this was when I was the Gironde area. After I had my meal with the mess kit, I'd go through it, wash it above. The way they would do, they'd have a very good idea, have several those GI cans, big, about 20-gallon cans with a fire under it, hot, and you'd put your rescue in there, dip it in there, with a handle on it, dip it in there, clean it. But I would clean mine and go back through again, load it up, and the children were there. And the little French children were hungry. Mm-hmm. Invariably, we'd feed the children. Mm-hmm. That to me was a pretty sad sight.
Mm-hmm. Do you know French? Did you learn it while you were there?
I've studied it since, and I studied some then, but I can't speak it well. Mm-hmm. Do you speak French?
Just a little.
Do you speak German?
No. Do you?
Yeah, well, ambition.
So, did you go to Germany as well after?
Yes, after.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
That is interesting, and I have the order. That I have the orders mm-hmm. here. And I'll give you a copy. And it shows my name there, Frank. I believe I was a corporal at that time. And my serial number, 15577. You don't find that number except in this would be a small group in regular army. Mm-hmm. In Germany, taking the prisoners back, I remember it quite distinctly. There'd be several hundred of them. And then in the middle of the car was a coach where the tent where the what an escort was. And when they first came into Germany, oh no, I'll tell you something that happened before we got to Germany. Whenever we'd stop in a place, I'd hop out, run, get a little exercise, mm-hmm. running up the deck, up and down the deck. And I missed my coach. So when the Germans held his arm out, he just brought me aboard in the freight car. So I was sitting in the freight car. And off in the distance was a French prisoners and a French guard. And the French guard took a shot at the, impulsively, just took a shot at the train. And came in the same apartment that I was in. Well, I didn't know. I thought the fellow was killed. But years later, I was in Santos, Brazil, and I was quite interested in the coffee plantations and asked our agent if he could supply some photographs of the coffee plantations. He sent a man to the ship, and I have the pictures now, quite large ones. And his speech was spoke English quite well, but with a decided American accent. So I was curious, and he said yes, that he had been a prisoner of the Americans, and maybe that was where he developed the American accent. So compared notes, and he told me about. I asked if any unusual experience had occurred, and he told me about the prison guard shooting at the train.
Oh, wow.
Well, now, in Germany, the first stop we made in Germany, their equivalent of the Red Cross wanted to welcome them and give them some coffee. So they all lined up. Well, I lined up too, with my coffee cup. So when we came along, elderly gentleman with a neat beard poured out the coffee, and I said, "Danke, sir." Das Café is sehr gut. Well, with that, he reached behind the counter and brought out a loaf of potato bread, I guess it was, gave me a slice. Danke, sir. Das Brot ist sehr gut. And I got some sausage after that. See, there is the advantage of knowing the foreign language.
Yes. Do you remember the men from your unit? Do you remember the men from your unit? Did you make friends with any of them?
Where?
In your unit.
Oh, with the units. One that I have met was this man here.
Do you remember his name?
Oh, certainly do. James Powell. Potter, I mean. And he was from Providence, Rhode Island.
Did you keep in touch with him?
Yes. I kept in touch with him. And I went up to Providence to see him. Mm-hmm. And he was in the jewelry business. And during his time over there, he was a cook. And he was a cook in the officer's mess. And naturally, I'd be good friends with the cook. Because
yeah.
I was always friends. Hungry.
Were you with him in France or Germany?
No, just in France.
In France?
No, just in England. Not after that.
How long were you in Germany?
Oh, just a matter of months.
Mm-hmm.
When we took them they went to Koblenz, went to Limburg with the prisoners, and then back to Koblenz for assignment. And somehow or other, I don't know what the other men and officers did or what their assignment was, but I was left with the boxcar. So I stayed in the boxcar for a day or two, and then I found where we were parked at the railway station that I could go up to the railway station and have my lunch for just a very, very minimum amount. And then when it came, they were treating the Americans to Rhineland trips, Koblenz. It's right across from Fort Ehrenbreitstein. And they're treating Americans to trips down the Rhineland. Well, when they were about ready to start, I'd be standing up in a doorway near the point of going aboard the vessel, fall right in line, and keep moving until we got underway.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a day of entertainment. And
mm-hmm. Did you have leave time?
Huh?
Did you have leave while you were in France or Germany?
Yes, I did. And I have, no, not in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I went around there some. What I have, and I have this order, I have the original orders of the only vacation that I ever had in Europe. And that was in from headquarters in, I guess, Central Peace, the place I was picking up the Germans. And they didn't give me a pass alone, but one man with me, a Sergeant Henry, whose father, he said his father was a colonel in the army, and he didn't smoke or drink, but he took 6 cartons of cigarettes with him, because we'd use that for money. And we went down to Arras, not the main Arras that you see in France, but the one on the Bay of Arcachon, a small little place. Stayed at a little hotel. at the Hotel de Puy, and I have postcard pictures of the place and the postman who delivered some of his mail on stilts because it would be underwater at a certain time. Well, oh, and the little Hotel de Puy had a reception for us. Invited everybody in for the evening to have a glass of wine and dance in the hotel. I didn't dance, but I moved around. I had 5 or 6 cartons of cigarettes too. And I didn't smoke at that time. So, here our vacation was up. And I wasn't going to go back. I still had my money. So I decided we'll go down to Beirut. Took the train, went to Beirut. A sergeant, and at the railway station, there'd be different carriages from the hotel. Well, Sergeant Henry went to, I didn't see him again until we were ready to leave. He stayed a little help in the lobby before I was received. There's a captain there. Captain, I want to tell you something. On the train going down, Sergeant Henry and I had an apartment. You know, those little apartments. Mm-hmm. Train, compartments. Mm-hmm. And French officers came through. We knew we had to give it up to them. So they came in, you know, very importantly. So we presented it to them as if we were giving them. Well, this American officer, a captain, says, "What are you doing here?" I looked him in the eye and I said, "You tell me, sir, what are you doing here?" I never saw him again. Hmm. Well, my room, while I was there, I was there several days. I thought it was rather strange that I got so much service up there. But I guess every servant in the hotel came in and take a look at me. Because here was an unusual situation to see an American staying at the aristocratic hotel, because mm-hmm. that's where the aristocracy of Europe would go.
Tell me about the fact that you had gone AWOL. You had to go back.
Mm-hmm. starting where?
Pick up again after you left the hotel.
Oh, after I left the hotel. Mm-hmm. Oh, and going back to. When we got back to our station, we had been AWOL, and naturally we were subject to some discipline. And I told my story to the young lieutenant about the experience of going on, taking the extra time due to the fact that I had all the cigarettes they could use instead of money, and went to Beirut and stayed at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. When I told him about it, he was so enjoyed the story that he said, "I wish I could have done that myself." I didn't get any fine, so nothing on the record. Mm-hmm.
Did you travel anywhere else? Besides France?
Well, not, of course, in England, in southern England. Mm-hmm. Very interesting in southern England, particularly when I had the, when I had the motorcycle, sidecar, Mrs. Selfridge, who was Selfridge of the Veal family of Chicago, lived at Highcliff Castle, her family did, and they were having a funeral. And I took this pager, I had to have some official American there, because she was American. And the major, I took this major, and at the place, they had small cabins for 19 Americans who were there on recuperating. And they were made so that you could get outside and turn them, so they'd turn them with the sun. And at the funeral, they wondered, well, what are you going to do with me? So they put another black band on my arm, and I was the 20th member at the funeral. And the major was taken around by some official, and the 19-year-old daughter took me around to show me the highlights of the castle. And when the very first time that I used the motorcycle, I took Captain Cotton from Texas, who had been in Europe as when he first graduated from college and was given a grand tour. He made a bicycle tour of Europe and was quite knowledgeable. And we went first, I took him to Winchester College. And I was really fascinated by the college. And he told me all he knew about the Norman architecture. Mm-hmm. And the first opportunity, I went on my own. And very soon, when we'd have a visiting officer, and he'd want to go into the town of Winchester, they say, well, let Buckles take it. Mm-hmm. And the curator, I guess you call him, of the cathedral had a son who had gone out to, very young, to France and killed. So he took a particular interest in me and showed me many things of interest about that cathedral that I've been there many times since, and people don't even know. For instance, he took me down below to the tunnel which led up to the castle in Winchester, and he gave me a candle, and I walked back in there for several yards anyhow. And I've also been in the castle, and I told them about the tunnel, and they didn't even know that the tunnel was there.
Wow. When you were working, did you feel under a lot of pressure, or was it stressful?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No.
How was I going to be stressful? Mm-hmm. Not in those days.
No. Were you ever scared to be there?
No. Mm-hmm. No.
Did you ever feel at a disadvantage because of your age? Did you feel much younger than everyone else?
No.
Were there others your age as well?
Not very many.
Mm-hmm.
No, because anybody asked me my age, I just look them in the eye and tell them I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after a while, men in the uniform all look alike.
Yeah. No one questioned you about it. When you were an escort in Germany, did you ever talk or interact with the prisoners?
Oh, yes, and I did before we went. Mm-hmm. While we were still at San Francisco Peace, before we embarked the prisoners, yes, I met them and talked to them there. Mm-hmm. I remember one incident there. I don't know what happened or why. I had gone for some official reason in the evening to get some information, and a young German was probably about my age, and I got into an argument, and two of the older Germans took me by the shoulders and took the other man by the shoulders and told him that the whole camp would get into trouble if we got into a fight. Now you have to make up.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. And also, at the German prisoners, they had their own orchestra. And they had, some of them in civilian life were quite competent musicians. And outside the wire fence, American soldiers had put up a few boards and some barrels to sit on, mm-hmm. and listen to the music. Mm. Oh, and when I think about these things, remember, I've never told anybody about my experiences except my daughter Susanna and wife Audrey. And I never talked to people about it because people didn't know I was had been in the army. Mm-hmm. But the pictures come back to me as the pleasant things. The unpleasant things, I don't remember those. I forget those
really, purposely.
But here is one that stays, this is a picture that is in my mind. The Germans would go out to work. This was in France. And they go out to work and there'd only be one guard with them. When the day was over, they'd return. And this particular time, it must have been this soldier, American soldier, must have been his payday or something, because while they were working, he sat down at to have a cafe in France, all you need is a chair and a table and a bottle of wine. And by the time it came to leave, he was pretty well under the influence of the wine. So the picture I got was a German smoking his pipe, a wheelbarrow, and the soldier in it. Behind him, another German with the soldier's rifle in his position, taking them back to the camp. If I could sketch it, that to me was a really an interesting picture.
Mm-hmm. So in general, your memories are pleasant? Mm-hmm. Your memories of that time were pleasant?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't you tell people about these experiences or those days?
Well, now, we'll go back to the time the war was over. I came back on the the ship, the Pocahontas. After being over 2 years and a half in the Army, and over 2 years overseas, it was quite a different life to me. From the time I was 15 years of age, I was treated as an adult. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, I decided I was going to and be independent. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go back. I was still just 18 years old after I spent all this time in the Army. And I thought the quickest way to get out, get a job, was to go to a business school and take shorthand and typewriting, and then I'd have a job at the headquarters where I'd be right close to making where the decisions were made. Mm-hmm. So I did that. In about 4 months, the YMCA did give me a 1 month free membership. Mm-hmm. That's the only consideration I ever saw given to a soldier after the war.
Do you remember much about the day when your service ended?
Oh, yes, yeah, sure.
What was it like?
Well, what they did from, I guess, Camp Merritt, New Jersey, where we assembled first, they sent troops to the nearest station from where you live. And this Camp Pike, Arkansas, would be the nearest, maybe 150, a couple hundred miles from Oakwood, Oklahoma, where my parents lived at that time. Mm-hmm. So what was your question?
Do you remember much about the day? What was the day like when your service ended?
Yes, I remember it quite well. We lined up, and a very gentlemanly young man acted as he took the data to make out your discharge. And the man behind him would say, just the same. So it made it easy for him. Mm-hmm. And I know that I was paid off with $143.50, including my $60 bonus. But on the way, I went from there to Oklahoma City, and I went around to a business school and signed up. Mm-hmm. Then went on to Clinton, and it took me about 2 days to get out there.
I'm sorry, you went where for business school?
What?
Where did you go to business school?
Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm. Let me just backtrack for a minute. Were you awarded any medals or citations?
Oh, the Victory Medal, and I thought I had them. No. Just the Victory Medal with the Clasp of France. And the one, it's called the Army of Occupation with Germany. And it has General Pershing's victory on it. And then, of course, I got this one from the President of France.
This was in 1999?
Yes.
What was this occasion?
Jacques Chirac, the President of France, decided to give all of the remaining veterans of World War I the Légion d'honneur, and then decided to include the American. France at that time had, so they told me, only about 1,000. And he decided to include the Americans. And he sent a French photographer over to get them. They found out about me and sent a photographer over to take pictures. And he spoke no English. So the young lady from Life magazine in Paris accompanied him as the interpreter. Mm-hmm. And it ended up with a magazine article in Life magazine. At me.
How many American veterans were there?
I counted. I tried to find. I wanted that information, and the American Society of the Légion d'honneur gave me the list, and I believe there were 254 on that list, and that was dated a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now the veterans of war, at the time the armistice was signed, there were 4,734,991. But we don't know today. I've tried various sources, yes, and they use some old statistics. But I'll say that probably there are 700 of those veterans still living.
Hmm. Are you in touch with any of them?
Yes, the one out in. When the article appeared in the Life magazine, I got a telephone call from Portland, Oregon, from Mr. Howard Ramsey out there, who's now 103 years old, and invited me to come out.
Did you go?
And I went.
What was that like?
Well, that was very interesting. It was a living history day, and it was started 6 years ago by a gentleman named Ken Buckles,
mm-hmm.
who is was a football coach and also a teacher in the high school. And they've had it every year since. And now about 20 high schools take part in it. And there were 10,000 people at the reception. Or the event, I should call it.
Mm-hmm. You went to business school in Oklahoma. Then what did you do?
I went to business school. My mind, I changed a great deal. So did other soldiers change. When all those several million men that's all at once back in civilian life. On the downtown was a pool hall right in the middle of the one of the main streets. A big place. Sort of a meeting place for soldiers. I didn't play pool, but then, many of the men there didn't either, but they went for the meeting. And I'd meet people coming through there from all over the country, on the way someplace else, looking for a job. And I met one man that I remembered because his name was Woodruff, and my middle name is Woodruff. And he was on the way to Mexico. Well, I found then that I was associating only with Army men. I didn't talk to anybody if he hadn't been in the Army. Because I was only 18 years old after I came back. So, I got a job, and the classes were out by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I got a job in the post office, working from 4 o'clock until, I guess it was midnight. And I kept my checks at the end of the month, cashed them in, and went to Canada. So I only stayed in the country about five or six months. Mm-hmm. And I went to Canada. In Canada, nobody ever asked me about my military service. They didn't think I was old enough. So I got a job at the White Star Line, White Star Dominion Line.
Shipping line?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where in Canada?
Toronto. Mm-hmm. And the Royal Bank Building, the tallest building in the British Empire at that time, 20 stories high. of course, I got a job also at night with the Great Northwestern Telegraph Company across the street. The manager didn't have a job for me, but he said he'd make one so I could work at night. Mm-hmm. And went to a business school there. And then after 1921, I decided to go to New York. Oh, I took another job with an automobile company where the pay was much greater than my $65 a month with the White Star Line. I didn't complain because the two freight solicitors were paid $25 a month when they started, something like that. And Mr. J.W. Wilkinson, the manager, who had been with the Elder Dempster Line in the Canary Islands, his parents paid the company for him to start working. So why was I to complain? But out of this advanced salary that I got there, $25 a week, I stopped in the bank and put half of it in the bank every Saturday afternoon till I had money enough. Went to the best tailor in Toronto and had a suit to lose me. Then I went to New York. But I did go into the, and the White Star Line. They kept a scrapbook, full size for newspapers. I could look back there and see the article on the Titanic in the Carpathia. But I never mentioned to anybody that I had been on the Carpathia until the day I started to go to New York. And the manager asked me if I'd ever been in New York. I said, yes. I sailed from New York on the Carpathia in December 1917. What? Well, he says, when you get to New York, you go to the White Star Line. Mr. A.C. Fedorov, the freight traffic manager, and they'll have a job for you. I didn't go. I went afterwards to when I wanted to go aboard the Homeric, which was in New York on its maiden voyage. And they gave me the authority to go aboard.
Did your military experience influence the choice of career?
Did it influence?
That the career that you chose.
The career? Well, I suppose so. I didn't talk about it, but it had a great deal of influence on my life.
You said that you felt changed when you came back. How did you feel different?
Well, I went through the, I'll go back. I went down to Oklahoma. I took a load of draft, virtue and draft mares and some equipment down to Oklahoma when I was 15 years old. Went to the bank because they were the only people I knew, and stayed at the bank, stayed at the little hotel across the street, and went to school there. So I was doing things pretty much on my own. So then, going in the Army, where I was treated as not as a boy, I was treated as a man, 21 years of age, as I tell them if they ask. I had the feeling, well, and going to this business school, there were the soldiers who were there, all of them I knew were going from government expense. They were given 1 year at $80 a month if they were missing a leg or an arm. And one of them had been had a bullet in his spine, and he's the only one that had all four limbs. And I just didn't have any connection with the civilian people. And the clothing, of course, to get back in, most of the boys wore the part of their uniform or all of it to school, because clothing was suddenly so very expensive. Even a shirt that probably before the war, I wouldn't know what the cost before the war, probably 50 cents. Price went up $4 or $5. And so some of them decided to wear their farm uniform. Overall, that price escalated.
Did you join a veterans association when you came back?
Yes, the Chamber of Commerce. The meeting was at the Chamber of Commerce. And I remember the man in charge of the General Roy Hoffman of the Oklahoma National Guard gave a talk and said, as far as we know, it'll have no connection with politics. They gave us all a big cigar and enjoyed the, I probably gave a free membership. But that, of course, I went to Canada, I never mentioned it again, until I started to see. And the, in 1931, I became a life member of the life member of the American Legion, life member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I've never been to the Foreign Wars, but I'm a life member, and I'm a life member of the Legion. It was for steamship people, and I've had occasion to go to probably three meetings.
So you went to sea? You started working at sea?
In Toronto, I was with the White Star Line. Had been in up to, when I came to Toronto, I had all my clothes just in one little bag. That's all my total possessions. And when I went to New York, I got off at Grand Central. I was going, in Toronto. Here is what has influenced my life. I knew that the YMCA would have a gymnasium and also have a swimming pool. So I went to the YMCA. And the instructors there were drill masters. And in no time I was in number one class. So that was my free my club and my free entertainment. And then when I went to New York, I was dressed, well dressed. I carried all my baggage. I carried it from the Grand Central Station to 318 West 57th Street to save the 25 cents or whatever it was to have a taxi cab.
What was on 57th Street?
Hmm?
What was on 57th Street?
The YMCA.
Okay.
They didn't have a place for me because the YMCA doesn't take you unless you have a job. They can leave the Christian out of them. but I always, the first time in New York, I always lived three different places, but within walking distance, within a block of the gymnasium. Mm-hmm. And in no time I was a volunteer, the instructor of the boys' department of the gymnasium and calisthenics instructor.
So what kind of job did you take in New York?
Oh, New York? Well, I had $5 on deposit at the YMCA. In case I got a job, they'd take the money. I went into the George Batten Advertising Company. Afterwards, George Batten, Barton, Dustin, Erston. And a very fine manager there gave me a job to start the first of the month. I talked him into starting, this is on Friday, I talked him to start me on Monday. Mm-hmm. By this time, I had $49 and a half when I got to New York. By this time, I was down to pretty low, and they gave me a job, and it was just before Christmas, and they also gave everybody in there, in a little box, a little white box, a $20 gold piece. I made application to various places. Among them was the Bankers Trust Company. The prestigious Bankers Trust Company. Using as that little bank in Oklahoma, 10,000 capitalization as my reference. It took them some time to get the answer because Mr. K.D. Gossam, the president, was out in California. Well, the bank wrote me a note saying that I had been accepted and to report a certain time. So I took my $20 back and gave it back to him. He said I couldn't take that because I'd accepted another job. But they said, keep it. Well, the Bankers Trust Company was quite an interesting experience. I was in the bond department. There are only five of us in the bond department there, not aside from the bond salesman. And we did the trading with the Bankers Trust Company at that time consisted of three places, 16 Wall Street, 501 Fifth Avenue, where I was, Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street, a branch over on Park, and a branch in Paris. Well, if in no time at the gymnasium, that was my principal. You couldn't if you were hungry, you still didn't eat anything in the gymnasium. And within very brief time, I met some interesting men in the gymnasium too. And one of them would a friend of his would meet him in the tea room after the gymnastics exercise, and they were talking among themselves, what should they do for this young man who just come down from Canada? And this man about town, who was very much of a New Yorker, you could tell that. He's really Jimmy Walker of New York type. They began to discuss what they could do for me. I said, well, let him get into one of the regiments. And both of these men were Irish. So I said, well, we can get him into the 69th. Oh, no, there's too many Irishmen there. You know what the 69th is, Donovan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And made a great name for themselves in World War I. And the 7th Regiment, which is up at 34th Street, in part. He says, we'll get him into the 7th Regiment. They're really the top one. One of the top ones. And he made some telephone calls, and I received a letter, and was in. So that was one of my contacts. And I believe they gave you $1.50, might be $2.50 for each attendance you made. And that covered my incidental expenses of the regiment. But then I began to think about the steamship business. And I had a friend who he lived at the YMCA, about my age, Charles Dean Stearns. His father was president of Philip Sandover. His grandfather had been president of forget the university that he was president of, but Charlie Stearns went there for 1 year, and he told his father that Amherst. He went to 1 year at Amherst with another friend of mine, Henry C. Wolfe, the writer. He said that he had all the college education he needed. He was going in the steamship business. And he made a trip to the Orient. Made a trip with Standard Oil. His father Calvin Coolidge and the president of Standard Oil had all been classmates. So this man of the Standard Oil said, "Oh, we'll give him the, we've got the presidential suite over there." And the father said, "No, you give him, put him in there as an ordinary seaman, so that you get it out of his system in one." Mm-hmm. Well, he was, came back as a quartermaster of the trip. Ship made one, actually went on around the world. So we had a lot, we had a lot in common, and made plans of what we could do in the shipping business. But first, I had to have some experience at sea. And that wasn't easy to get a job if you have no experience at all. I managed it through, not through the manager, the head of the pond department, because he gave me an introduction to Mr. Phillips, who is the president of the that steamship kind of line that went out to Hawaii, Bermuda, Furness Bermuda line. And I already knew what ship I wanted to go on, what line I wanted to go with. So this, I don't know how the fellow could be a president of a company being so dumb, but he called up the the port captain of this, of the barber line, and brought him into the office, and in front of me told him to give him a job. Well, I went over to see the colonel. He had been a colonel in the army, and you could see he didn't like that attitude at all, and I didn't get that job, but I did eventually. Then Wally Hogson, one of the salesmen, was a classmate of another steamship man with the old Munson line to South America. So I was right on my way. Instead of making a voyage or two, I liked it. I was very well suited for that. I knew how to get along with I was just at home in Italy.
Let me just jump ahead. I understand that you were eventually in the Philippines.
Yes.
And what were you doing there? And I understand you got caught up in Japanese occupation.
Well, I went out, the war started in Europe. I went out to San Francisco. Our ships, five ships, were taken over as Marine Corps transport. And that left me looking for something new, assignment. And I went out to San Francisco. And Roger Lapham, the chairman of the Board of the American Hawaiian Line, they had two jobs offered me. One of them was to go to Buenos Aires with the captain of the port for the Moore McCormick line. Elderly gentleman who would retire eventually, so I could have had a good job there. The other one was to go to the Philippines to expedite the movement of cargoes for this American president line. I'd been in the Orient. I was out there in 1929. I was out there many times after that. And I had no intention of being an old China hand. But I knew that I knew how to handle this job, and I expected to go out there and get my job over and come back to San Francisco. That's how I got out there. Mm-hmm. And then When I knew we were going to get into the war, but I didn't expect it was going to be so soon. Mm-hmm. So I was there when the war started. I'd watched the Blooming War build up in Europe. I was in Europe from 1931 to 1938 during the Hitler period. Well acquainted with that. Now I go out to the Orient and the war starts out there.
Mm-hmm. What happened when you were in the Philippines?
What
happened when you were in the Philippines?
Oh, well, of course, it's December the 8th in the Philippines when it's 7th here. Same thing, and within a few hours, the Japanese were bombing the various installations, including the piers, which I would be associated with, mm-hmm. the steamship business. Mm-hmm. So I watched that from the very start. I really know that that part of it.
Mm-hmm. And were you captured, or what?
Oh, well, what they did, MacArthur had declared Manila as an open city and removed all the military, thinking that they would leave the place. So the civilians who were there would just remain in their homes. Well, that story is quite different. People in this country don't. War, we were so closely associated with Europe that they forgot about the Orient. And unfortunately, they were told in the Orient, instead of telling them to go on back to the States, they told them Manila was the safest place in the Orient. Mm-hmm. So the manager and staff from our Tokyo office, from Shanghai, also came down to Manila. And we even had a ship that was coming through. With passengers aboard. While the passengers were off the ship went on. Well, with me, I lived on El Garral, right near the Bayview Hotel, and I always walked back and forth from the piers. Our office was right close to the piers. I don't know just what I should tell you. What would you, what is it you want to know about?
Well, I thought that you spent some time in some kind of prison camp.
Oh, the prison camp.
Yes.
Oh.
I wanted to hear about that.
Oh, all right. I'll tell you just about the prison camp. It was decided in Manila that Santo Tomas University would be the ideal place for the people to go. It covers about 40 acres right in the city. And there were large buildings, including the university building and some annexes that had been built on. Well, they gave out instruction to uh, to go to Santo Tomas and take 3 days' supplies with you. So many of them went to the hotels, many of them living there. They would go in trucks and so forth. And how did I go? Mine was a little bit different. I lived on El Garel, a little street near the Bayview Hotel, and I was a little late in getting there. There were two Argentine highlight players in the building, topside in the building where I lived, and they. I have an Argentine cedula, so I carried my Argentine cedula, little passport, in case I was stopped on the street. I'd speak to them in Spanish and tell them that I'm who I was. Now, I was late getting in. And most of them complained about their way they went to the prison camp, I didn't have any problem about that, because they had already told me to be prepared a certain day. And here, Japanese civilian came in, or two of them, two Japanese civilians, with a rough, uncouth Japanese guard, came into my place, had a little apartment, and so if you know the what a making face is in the Orient, Japanese guard, big fellow, tall, big gun, two little Japanese soldiers, civilians in between, and poor little prisoner, me. Mm-hmm. They started looking around the place, and they saw Chris, a friend of mine had given me, a real good one, and they took the Chris. Then they went into the two rooms, and they saw a pistol there. And belonged to my, it was a handmade pistol, belonged to my Uncle Lyndon in Larned, Kansas, who was a gun expert and Indian, honorary Indian chief and so forth. And of his collection, I chose this one because it was unusual. And you couldn't just pick it up and like a conventional pistol. So the Japanese, he took the Japanese pistol. I saw he couldn't handle it, so I grabbed it out of his hand. The Japanese soldier, come way down here. Two civilians up above. Me, I'm up top. So the two civilians took the Sovale mat and said, you must take a lot of food. And I had a crate, a case of canned food that I had gotten from the market for emergency. So they took me in a car out to the camp.
You spent quite a lot of time there, didn't you?
Yes.
How long did you spend?
3 years and 2 months.
Oh, my gosh.
So the experience in the camp was, the bad part was the starvation.
How did you cope? How did you cope with that?
Well, I, by choice, immediately became the number one in the number one work crew, labor crew. Because sometimes I'd get an extra can of soup or something. There was no provision. Well, naturally, the Japanese had never had experience with the prisoners.
So people were always hungry. People were always hungry.
Yes.
Was it tough in other ways as well? Was it hard in other ways as well?
Yes, it's such a long story.
Yeah.
It's been written, well written up many times.
Well, let me go back again to your military service and ask you more broadly, do you feel that your experiences during the war, how do they affect your life?
Again, what?
Your experiences in the war.
Yeah.
The First World War.
Yeah.
How do you think they affected your life, in the course of your life?
Well, even though I didn't talk about it and didn't discuss it with people, I knew that that had a that I was entirely different. When I came back, not associating with anyone except the military, and I knew that it was the best thing for me to do is to get out of that atmosphere. Not to continue to talk about it, to go out on my own.
Why was that best for you?
Well, it's best for anyone who has been in the military service, if he's had some disagreeable experiences. It's best for him to talk about it, get it out of his system, and then forget it. Of course, I didn't talk about it.
Did you feel you had disagreeable experiences?
No.
Yeah.
No. Not really.
Did your experience affect your thinking about the military or other wars?
No, I don't think so. The way I feel about it is, you don't start the war, of course, but there are reasons for starting the war that
there are reasons for starting
the war. Yes. When a war starts, the main thing that you have to think about is your country is involved, and whatever small details that may occur that don't appeal to you, you still have to go through it. And I believe that's the attitude we in the Far East. We were left alone. And I know that it was the intention, because I had heard the president saying that about help is on the way. He had intended that, and we had intended to get some help, but we couldn't. Europe had to come first. So it was, many of them think how tragic it was that we were totally ignored. But the defenders of Bataan and Corregidor, held out for months. The Japanese had planned, and we know from Japanese plans, that they had expected to go right through the Orient. Asia for the Asiatics, and that they also expected to take Australia. And if they had been able to take Australia, it wouldn't have been easier to get it back.
When you first joined in World War One,
yes,
was it difficult because so many people in this country were opposed to our involvement in the war?
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, you didn't know about that.
Yeah.
What I did.
My father took newspapers. I read about the war. I knew all about the Titanic and the Carpathia too when I was a little boy, and although I was only 11 years old, but I knew about it because I read about it, and I had the amateur wireless outfit. And the wireless operators were very close. That was the news that I...
Did you know much about the countries that you were serving in before you went?
Oh, I sure did. Well, I knew about England. And then when I saw King Alfred's statue down in the bottom of High Street, and on the... When I went down to the little town, and I saw distinguished-looking, at least distinguished dress, of a man with a long robe, colorful robe, and a hat that looked like a bishop's hat, and found that there were soldiers from the Crimea, dating back to 1853. And then when I went to the cathedral and see Rufus the Red, the third son of William the Conqueror, who is buried in there, or no, is entombed with the sarcophagus. Yes, I was quite conscious.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about your experience that you'd like to talk about? We don't have much time left.
Oh, yeah. Well, just a few words. When I started in the steamship business in Toronto, it probably those letterheads with all the beautiful flags on it, the ship's flags, and came to New York, started to see with the old Bunsen line. I was just a year on the Western world. Then I went over to England. I was still thinking about South America because I was studying, I speak Spanish. And seguramente que voy a hablar casi lo mismo como inglés. And then all these experiences, one of them led to the other. I wasn't looking for additional experience, it just occurred to me.